This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, home of New York's craft cider. I love New York. Plan your getaway at visitithaca.com.
Hey, hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio. It's Tuesday, October, what's the date today, Chris? 12th, 2021, and it's our 600th episode, and I'm very excited to be in Boston at the new Notch Brewing at Charles Speedway in Brighton, which is next to Austin. Some of you know Austin from Deep Ellum, which was a great craft beer bar, and it's my first time out here at the new Charles River Speedway. We're talking about traditions. Yesterday was the Boston Marathon, which was pretty special. We came in today. There's a lot of people with the shirts on, and there's a lot of meaning for the Boston Marathon, especially since so much has happened in Boston and in America the last year or so. I'm also going to give a shout out to our co-host, our host of Cutting the Curd, unfortunately, Ann Saxby, a very dear friend, passed away this weekend. And we just want to give just a special shout out to her as a very important person in our food community and a pioneer of the American farmstead cheeses in New York. And my message is her legacy is in everything around us, food we eat, people we know, memories of tastes like Comersdale and Moses Sleeper. We will never forget. Much love. Okay, so that's a big cheers to Ann Saxelby. And now we're going to start our show here, 600th episode. Thanks so much for Heritage Radio Network for keeping us on the air every week for 12 years. So our guest today, he's going to take it away and introduce himself. This is Chris of Notch Brewing. Chris, so great to see you, man, and congratulations on opening this place.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be the 600, well, not guest, but on the 600 episode. And thanks for being here in Brighton, our second taproom brewery in Massachusetts, in the Brighton neighborhood of Boston. Been here since July. We were supposed to open a long time ago, but COVID halted construction, and you know we can all sing the sad songs of what we've all been through. But that was a challenge. But here we are, and we're open, and feeling good about it. I'm really glad to have you here, and look forward to talking more about decoction and other fun things.
Well, what's exciting is that a year ago I got to see you during COVID in Salem, and I got to taste this beer, the Pitch Lined Pils, which is kind of mythical. I don't think anyone else is making it. And it just worked out that today, the day after the Boston Marathon, I'm here in Boston. And so, Chris, tell us about this beer. You are the only person making it in America. There's a long history, and you can talk as much as you want because this beer is worth seeking out.
I appreciate it. This project has been something I've wanted to do for a long, long time. And as the deeper I got into it, the more I realized it wasn't just about a check process. It was more about the history of beer. It's an amazing, amazing path that we went through to discover that, you know, previous to stainless steel and aluminum metals being used in brewing, every brewer in the United States and the world used wood for fermentation vessels, for conditioning vessels, lagering tanks, and for service kegs. And none of these brewers wanted the wood to come in contact with the beer. The beer has tannin and character that they felt had a negative influence over the beer. And this is a time during basically, you know, Pilsner and Pale Lager. So the fermenters were lined with a varnish, typically open, but the lagering tanks and kegs, the serving vessels, were pitch lined. Pitch is a combination of paraffin and resin. Each brewer had their own cocktail and where they sourced it. But basically that pitch was heated and then coated on these vessels to protect it from the wood. And then you know, have some oxidation prevention as well. So when I started thinking about this, it was really from one source. If we all remember the Michael Jackson's Beer Hunters series, I was in college when that came out, so that dates me quite a bit. I mean, most people weren't born when that came out, never mind drinking beer. So I saw this episode when he was in the Czech Republic and then in Pilsen and went to Pilsner Kell Brewery in the late 80s. And he saw the process in place previous to them going to stainless steel, where everything was open fermented in wooden lacquer varnished fermenters. And then everything was lagered for 3 months. in large wooden oak vessels that were pitch lined. And he went through the whole process in this, and I was fascinated by it. And that's been somewhat retired. Pilsner Kell still does that just to show how the process used to go, but all their production has been shifted to stainless. But some small producers in Bohemia and Bavaria still do this. And this is something I was always enthralled with, and just from a process standpoint, because as a brewer, I love process. So, you know, fast forward to 10 years ago when I started Notch, I was in Prague and I met up with Evan Rail, beer writer, travel writer for New York Times, and we started talking about this process. We were at this bar brewery in downtown Prague called Udmidviku at the Three Bears, and they were doing this process. We talked a lot about it. And one thing that Evan talked about was that the pitch would wear away and they would have to repitch the barrels over a period of time. And we got to the conversation of, well, the pitch is going somewhere, right? It's going into the beer. And so what is the influence of the pitch? What is the influence of the pitch on the beer? It must have some. So this started my whole thought of like, well, I really want to figure this out. I want to do this process. So 4 years ago, Brianne Allen joined Notch as a production manager. And so the two of us kind of brainstormed on how are we going to do this. So the two of us started down this path of finding pitch, brewer's pitch, and then finding barrels to be able to withstand carbonation, like beer barrels, not whiskey barrels, not wine barrels, not food. None of those can withstand carbonation to be able to actually condition this in the barrel. And so we had been purchasing some equipment, Franconian Stichfass and all the sundries that are required to do that. It's basically a German gravity cask. And so we became friends with this gentleman, Tom Clark, out of Berwick Brewing in Pennsylvania. And he's going to hate that I'm even saying his name because he wants to be, you know, in the wings and not known because he doesn't want to give away any information. But we became friends with him. And he had, and this is where this really goes off the rails into like a long history of brewing in history.
Go for it, man.
I probably lost half your viewers, your listeners already. So Tom had equipment from the Vernon Valley Brewery, which was in northern New Jersey, that in the late 80s, the owner imported an entire Bavarian brewing system, which included open wood vats, lagering vessels of wood that were pitch lined. And they had this process at a place called Action Park in New Jersey. And Action Park is legendary as one of the most unsafe amusement parks ever built. And that's a whole other story. But anyways, this brewery existed for about 4 or 5 years and made wonderful beer, but didn't make it. They were way ahead of the curve. I mean, not in craft beer, but just like making, you know, traditional Bavarian, Bohemian lager. So Tom had a bunch of this equipment stored away for years and years and years. He said, hey, you know, I got some of these, you know, basically wood barrels that you can pitch line. You can come get them from my brewery in Pennsylvania. So Brandon and I, you know, hopped in my pickup and drove down on this exploration. So I asked Tom, I said, well, we also need the pitch. We also kind of need to know how to effing do this. He goes, I can teach you. So he had pitch, not from Bavaria, not from Bohemia, not from Czech Republic. He had it from the old Pabst Brewery in Milwaukee that was making Ballantine under contract for a number of years. And Ballantine was open fermented in wood vats and then lagered, the triple X, not the triple X, but their IPA was lagered in pitch line barrels. So this is fascinating history to anyone who wants to geek out about this. So Tom was part of the decommissioning team at the Pabst Brewery, maybe late 80s, and basically had a bucket, a 5-gallon bucket of pitch that he saved all these years. So we were able to grab these historic Bavarian wooden vessels that Vernon Valley used, bring them to Notch in Salem, along with pitch from Milwaukee, and started coating these barrels. And then we took our Czech Pilsner, the standard, and we basically lagered in these barrels for a period of time. And we've been doing this now. This is the fourth iteration. It's basically 4 months every single time we do this. So it's been, production-wise, 3 years. Serving-wise, 2 years we've been doing this to find out the influences of pitch in the beer. So, I mean, a lot of questions come up in this, right? And people are probably raising their hands already. Why do you do this? If you're not
How many barrels do you actually make of this?
We have on order a lot more from Bavaria because we want to expand this. They're on order, and COVID's held that up, but they're on order to expand this whole production process. Right now, it's a very small amount. We have one 200-liter and one 100-liter wooden barrel that we pitch, So it's only about 6 kegs, you know, per batch. And it's more labor hours per beer than any beer in the world. But, you know, again, a labor of love and exploration on brewing history and Czech brewing. So, you know, we've gone through iterations of repitching every time, not repitching, feeling what the influences are on the pitch. And what we've landed on is, one, the pitch has influence. As an influence that's not unlike a hop. It's bitter. It's resiny. It's pleasant. And, you know, the extended lagering time definitely doesn't hurt that we lager these for 4 months. So right now, the batch that we have out, the version we have out, is a freshly or newly pitched barrel. So the influence of the pitch is going to be at its height. And that's the one we prefer because we can taste it. You can repitch because the pitch will still be intact, but it won't have the influence or the impact that a newly pitched barrel will have. And it's a wonderful beer. It's lagered really clean and great, but you don't really taste the pitch as much. And that's what happened on the third iteration. And so we're like, all right, why are we doing this if you can't taste the pitch, right? So we're now going to repitch every single time.
Chris, let's just go back. The pitch, so this tastes like something between one of your lightly smoked beers, like a Schlenkele Helles, and almost like a hop. Is that the influence of the pitch?
I mean, I don't think you're far off. I find less of a smoky character. That might be the resiny character. And I find more of that kind of bitterness that you would find in a highly hopped Pilsner that would have a lot of front end, you know, first wort or start of the kettle, or start of the boil hop character, which is not unpleasant. It's really wonderful. But it's definitely, it takes it definitely a degree away from the standard, which is our Pilsner, that is the base of this beer. But again, it is apparent. It's very much there. This is very much at odds with what's been going on in craft beer in terms of brewers taking Pilsner and putting it in raw wood or toasted wood or a fooder and aging it there to see what the effects are. And I understand that path. You know, brewers have that available. Why not try it? But I don't really like the effects of it. I like white wine. I like white wine has a lot in common with lager. I hate oaked Chardonnay. Like that character to me is very off-putting. And I find a lot of the same character in the pale lagers that touch oak. They just have this oak character to me. I don't like it.
So you think it's like they're trying to come up with fast solutions to adding new flavors?
No, I just think a lot of American brewers, like, we have this, why not try it? You know, it doesn't mean you should, but they can and they do. And I have had some fooder aged beers, or fooder fermented beers that are wonderful. I wouldn't call them a classic Pilsner. They go in a different category. But they do have their merits to explore and try. I don't really love them, but a couple have been, I found them pretty good. Local brewer here, Lamplighter, has done it and I've enjoyed those. Threes out of New York has done it. You know, I've enjoyed a few of those. Again, I'm not in love with them, but I understand why they're doing it. I understand the reasons why. And you know, when I asked the brewers, like, what are you trying to achieve with this? And their answers are very, I mean, they're solid. Like, we're trying to achieve X, Y, or Z. Like, and that's not what I'm trying to achieve in the pitch line pills. We have different goals. That's what makes craft beer great, which we can have different, you know, attacks on some of the same thing. But you know, I think what happened is a lot of brewers see wood, you know, in these old videos of Pilsner Kell, like, oh, that's wood-aged lager, without really doing the homework. Like, well, there's actually another process in between putting the beer in that barrel, and that's the pitch line process, and that's the magic.
So I came in early, and you were just setting up with your staff here at Notch Brewing, Charles River Speedway, Boston. You do a great job educating. I mean, this is a new beer, and you're answering their questions about this beer. Tell me what you told them about what the pitch is. Like, what is pitch? How is it sourced? Are you using the same old pitch that was sitting in your friend's tub for 30 years?
So pitch is a combination, again, of pine resin and paraffin. And brewers sourced the resin from various areas, you know, South America, Africa, Europe. Eucalyptus trees, different types of variety of trees, based upon what they were trying to achieve. Neutrality in the pitch, maybe some flavor enhancement of the pitch, and the paraffin helped to kind of maybe bind that. And that cocktail, if you will, was different from brewer to brewer. The pitch we use, we have no idea what that cocktail is because it came from the Pabst Brewery for Ballantine. And we'd have to go back to a historian that knew that, and I think that person's probably long gone. So we're still using that same pitch. So pitch can be reused. So when you repitch the barrel, what you basically do is heat the interior of the barrel so that pitch melts away, and then you recapture that as much as you can. And then when you pitch the barrel, the excess you then recapture as well because it will solidify, and it basically looks like, I don't know, like a piece of amber. Like it looks like a rock until you melt it. And so we're not really sure. So again, we have more barrels in order, and we actually have pitch coming from Munich that we're going to be using as well. And we'll probably see a difference in the pitch character that we had from this original source.
So there are new sources. You're not going to keep using the Pabst, and if that runs out, you'll never be able to do this again.
No, there are new sources. It's been a lot of work. Since we've started doing this, I've had a lot of brewers contact me saying, hey, where can I get the barrels? Where can I get the pitch? And my response is typical of myself, where if I don't know you, I don't even answer the question, never mind like trying to give you information on it. It's like, this has taken us so much time and effort and labor hours to get the resources to find it. And that's part of the fun. Part of the fun is actually doing the research, trying to find it, and trying to get to that. And not just someone handing to you like, all right, here you go. And I'm not going to hand that to anybody. If I know you, well, you're going to get a little more information out of me. I'll help you a little bit. But so we do have sources. And all it takes is traveling. It just takes going to the countries that where this is still done and just finding your way to it. To the point where I was in Franconia 2019 in the fall, just before everything, you know, shut down, the world stopped. And I was able to source this pre-World War II pitch boiler, which I've yet to bring to the United States because COVID hit and I just don't have the time for it, but I've sourced it. Where the pitch boiler is basically, first level is a wood fire. The second level is the pitch reservoir. And in that pitch reservoir is a piston assembly that is actuated by a foot pump to spray the pitch up to a spray ball into the barrel or cask.
And then about when was that made?
God, it was probably made about 1920. I'm not sure when the last time it was made.
We can say 1920 was the heyday of pitch technology, right?
Well, it's previous to, you know, stainless steel, infiltrating in brewing. But again, these projects for us, these are side projects for me that are fun. I really enjoy this. I've been at it for a long time, and I love brewing and production brewing, and I love everything about it, but I always want something on the side. Every brewer is going to say the same, keep you interested, keep your brain going, you know, pushing innovation, pushing cool things. And my innovation tends to be like, oh, let's look back into history, what was already done, and kind of like, let's pull from that, rather than like, you know, what's a new ingredient we can toss at a beer? Like, what's a process we can see that used to be done that we've lost through economies or, you know, whatever, like new materials. Like I always, there were influences of processes that were very positive, decoction being one of them, that was removed because it was more efficient to do it another way.
Okay, so when did you start doing decoction? Because you hear more people talking about it. Jeff Allworth's new The Beer Bible Second Edition's out, and he talks about it. But 5 years ago, no one else was talking about it.
Well, decoction was something I've wanted to do for a while. So my career trajectory was that I became an English ale brewer in 1993 because I loved British ale. I loved cask ale, hand pump, swan neck versus London neck, you know, sparkler versus no sparkler. I got into the minutia of cask beer, and I loved it because I love process. And then the brewery I was with after 11 years sold to a competitor, and then I got out of brewing for a few years, and that's when I took the trip to the Czech Republic in the mid-2000s. I was like, all right, I want to go all in on lager because I really love it. I love session beer. Czech beer is typically session beer. Most lagers typically have low ABV, you know, good drinking, a beer hall, beer garden beer. And so through that, when I started Notch, it wasn't until we were 5 years into Notch that we were able to build a brewery. Because we had to prove out the concept of session beer first, and we did that. We grew to a certain size, and then we built a brewery in Salem. And as soon as I knew we were going to build that brewery, I said, all right, we're going to do lager like it was done in the old world. Open fermentation, multiple decoctions, horizontal lagering, natural carbonation, and then, you know, pitch lining as well. So there's the concept of a sunken cost fallacy, where the more time and effort you put into it, the more you're going to believe that that was actually worth it, when the reality, the result may not be that. So I always thought, like, all right, I'm gonna go all in decoction, and at the end of it, I'm gonna realize it wasn't worth it. But what we found is that that's not the case. I found that decoction has a positive flavor and aroma influence on beer in a way I never imagined unless you did it. And I've heard a lot of brewers say, hey, you know, decoction is not worth it. You don't need to do it. Two responses to that. One is your cruts. To make sugar from malt, you don't need decoction, right? But that's not why we're doing decoction. We're doing decoction because of flavor. So I want to get into that a little bit more. You know, and the second is brewers who say you don't need it are typically brewers who can't do it, right? Because decoction brew house needs to be set up for decoction. You can fake it a little bit, but you're not going to, you're just fooling yourself into saying you're actually doing decoction, especially multiple decoction, where you can pull, mash, step it, boil it, return it, pull it, step it, boil it, return it. That multiple step process is really what influences.
So what's decoction is what? It's just you're reboiling?
So decoction is taking the steps of mashing from, say, you know, protein, or before that, acid, protein, saccharification to mash off, through those steps in a way that rather than just raising that temperature through a mash mixer, you're actually pulling the grain in a certain volume, typically a third, stepping that through the steps for that mashing program and finishing it in a boil. After boiling that mash, you then return it to the main mash to then step that up to that next mash level. So in that process, what's happening is that when you are boiling that mash, it's the Maillard reaction. It's a non-enzymatic browning process. Through heat on reducing sugars and protein, you're creating melanoidins. This is fact, right? So this is not some kind of like, oh, we're boiling the mash and it has a positive influence on the beer. This is a real reaction that's happening when you're decocting, and that's going to have a flavor impact on the end beer. And so we found that. Is it subtle? Yeah, it's subtle. Is it impactful? It's impactful. Do most people notice? Maybe not. So I can see brewers saying, well, 90% of my customers aren't ever going to notice, so why am I going to do that? Fair argument.
So I notice you do a great job of training your staff at the brewery, but you say you want them to be able to explain things to customers. How would they explain decoction to a customer saying, I'm getting this pills and it's decoction?
I think from what I just said, the very base explanation is decoction creates melanoidins. Melanoidins have a positive flavor attribute in the beer. It gives the beer a depth of flavor and aroma you can't otherwise achieve through either step or single temperature infusion. All right. Again, what I just said, the average consumer is going to look at you and be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So, you know, unless someone comes in and really wants to understand, we don't even talk about it. You know, we'll throw in our menu, it's double decocted, triple decocted. But for most consumers, they don't care. And that's okay. They just know they're drinking delicious beer.
One reason I wanted to come here, Chris, on the 600th episode of Beer Sessions Radio, is that I wanted to talk like this with you because as the industry is changing, the niche places, I mean, you're honestly a niche brewery doing really great beer, but you're also the kind of beer that I want to drink like every day. So thank you for doing what you do. Let's go back to this pitch line pills because I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I got to try it 2 years in a row. There was a question about the pitch. What is the pitch? Another question just is the barrels. Like, I mean, can you use any barrel? You mentioned something about a difference between what kind of barrels can you do carbonation in? I didn't understand that.
That's a great question. Again, I learned a lot in this process. I came into this knowing nothing, but eyes wide open, right? So beer barrels are different than wine barrels, than whiskey barrels, or even a fooder. So beer barrels have a very thick stave. So the width of the stave is very thick so that when that barrel is created, it can withhold carbonation. It can hold carbonation. It also can keep out the negative influences of oxygen coming through the wood into the beer. And so that was very, very important for us to find beer barrels and not just wine barrels or whiskey barrels. That would not have done it. Because all that lagering would have been done in an environment or in a barrel where that CO2 being created during the lagering process would have just gone to atmosphere. So we would have lost our carbonation. We might have had some oxygen intake as well. And so that's not what we were looking for. So the beer barrel sourcing was very, very important. You can still find beer barrels being created, but they're by very small producers, artisanal producers in Czech Republic and in Germany, and of varying sizes. Most are pretty small. They're mostly for serving, for stitch fast, you know, basically serving over the bar. But we've been able to source basically 200 liter versions of these, which are it's enough scale that makes sense. We've 8 200 liter barrels coming in that we're going to be able to pitch and do this at a bigger scale than we're doing currently, because you know, basically 200 liters every 3 months, it's really fun, but it's nothing more than just a promotion, you know, and so we want to be able to do it with a little more regularity and a little more volume so more people can try it.
Oh, this is great, man. I drank my pint. Is it a pint or a half pint?
Half liter
of the Pitchline Pils. You know, Chris, whenever I think about your beers, I know that if you run out of the Pitchline Pils, I'm going to be happy with what's next down the line. What else is tell, I think we're going to take a break a minute and talk about Charles River Speedway. So let's just take a short break. We're going to be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca, helping you to plan your next getaway. Ithaca has waterfalls and wineries, art and theater, outdoor recreation, and family fun. The area is famous for its glacier-carved gorges, co-op-run businesses, and cultural influences from Cornell University and Ithaca College. Plus, you can't beat the beauty of Cayuga Lake, the largest of the Finger Lakes. Beyond 150 waterfalls and some of the region's best hiking trails, Ithaca is cider. The area is well known for its local cideries, which are leading the way in America's cider revival. You can hear from the region's cider makers directly on HRN series Hardcore. There's something really special about Ithaca's climate for cultivating delicious apples steeped in history and terroir. Let Visit Ithaca help you plan your next trip to this hub of food, drink, culture, and agritourism. Home of New York's craft cider, I love New York. Get started at visitithaca.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Support us, become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. And a big, big, big hearty heaviness. Big tears for our friend Ann Saxby, passed away this weekend. So we're going to raise a glass to her. And I'm celebrating the 600th episode. Partly thanks to her, I would not be on this network without Ann Saxby. So we're here with Chris Loring at Notch Brewing, the new place in Brighton, which is part of Boston that I've never been to. Chris, tell us about this Charles River Speedway. This is quite a place. I mean, I have not... A friend of mine, James Ty, said... That's my favorite spot in Boston.
So Charles River Speedway, it's on the National Historic Register, and it was built in the late 1800s as the stables and offices for the Speedway racetrack that was along the Charles River for a number of years. And around about early 1900s, the track was demolished to make way for a road, Soldier Field Road. But the building was kept intact. It was a number of things over the years, but then fell into disrepair about 20 years ago. The state owns it, and the state was looking to basically, renovate the property and activate it. So our landlord, which is Architectural Heritage Foundation, is a nonprofit that won the award from the state to be the landlord and basically renovate the facility, and they're going to hold it for 60 years. So they asked us to be the anchor tenant. So I came down and took a look at it maybe 3 years ago now. And I stood in what was the courtyard where the horses gathered before they went off to the racetrack. And I looked at it and said, this could be Bavaria, this could be Bohemia, this beer garden could be something very, very special. Because even though you're in the city, it's surrounded by trees, and it's the entire facility surrounds the beer garden, so you don't know where you are. You can really picture yourself being anywhere. So we decided we wanted to be a part of it, and I'm really happy that we did. And that the renovation has been, because it's a historic property, has been, you know, very much on cue in terms of keeping the historic integrity of the property. So for us, we have, we're one of a few tenants, but we occupy the beer garden, which is basically 300-person capacity daily. It's surrounded by food stalls and retail shops. Very small scale. It's three food stalls and three retail shops. And then, you know, the brewery is in the anchor of that. We have a brewery here that we, it's fairly small. It's a 7-barrel brewery. It's augmented by production in Salem. But the only thing we brew here is lager. And 90% of that's Czech lager. So we have a decoction-capable brewery, open fermentation, the same thing we do in Salem. And then the difference is we serve directly from lagering tanks here. So our four Czech lagers that come through the Lucre Towers and Lucre Faucets that we have, and have had in Salem for 5 years. Yeah, the side pull. We were the second brewery in the United States to have those 5 years ago. I think Wayfinder beat us by a few months. God love them. And they're somewhat ubiquitous now, but you know, for us, it was the labor of love to be able to import those from the Czech Republic. So the lagering tanks, you know, then act as serving tanks as well. So we have 8 lagering tanks to be able to, you know, maturate and then condition and then serve. But it's a multi-use facility. So we have behind us is an old garage that's used for music festivals, etc. The beer garden has a built-in stage where there's live music and events on an ongoing basis. So it's an activated, pretty lively space. And it's been something that we've had a lot of fun, like, you know, seeing the transition from this being dilapidated to it coming back to what it should be. And it's a fun area in Boston, at the intersection of Brighton, Alston, Newton, and Watertown. But we've only been open for, you know, 3 months now. It's been so far a wild success.
Chris, what's cool about you is you reference Czech names, talking about places like Bohemia, Bavaria. Just talk us through some of the Czech names. You mentioned what I call a gravity keg. You have a word for that. And the different types of Czech lagers by color and strength. Just talk us through, because I do know that it seems like your staff is familiar with them, and I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, so I like to question a lot in that. So one of the things we wanted to do when we built, you asked about decoction, right? And so, yeah, so decoction was important, and the process and the brewing was important. But the way we served it to me was just as important, because if you travel to Germany and Czech Republic, the way they serve the beer is just as important as the way they brew it. And what I saw a lot of times in the United States was this disconnect in production of these wonderful beers and how it was served. And in Germany, most of the beers in Franconia or even in Munich are served through Stichfass. Stichfass is basically a gravity cask, where the beer is racked or filled in the barrel, carbonated and bright, but it's not pushed out with extraneous CO2 in a keg. It's tapped, and then it's allowed to dispense through gravity pour. And the texture is much different. It's not as prickly. It's a little smoother. It can raise a degree or two in temperature, and the beer really shines in that service. In the Czech Republic, most of the beer is served through Lucre faucets, which are these ball valve side pull faucets that create this dense, creamy, wet foam that you cannot replicate any other way. It's very unique. Some people have called it a gimmick, but that's only those who don't really understand what's happening. It's really a wonderful way to serve beer, especially Czech Pilsner, Amber Lager, and Dark Lager. So for us, it was very important to be able to do those same things, and the way we serve it was just important as the way we brew it. So and same thing, you know, in Brighton, we have, you know, two faucets of eight Lucre, two towers of 8 Lucre faucets to be able to produce that. So, I mean, to your point, to your question, so Czech lagers that we sell, we just basically use the style name. And so that's enough, right? We don't need to create fanciful names, because Tamave, that's a name. Tamave's dark. Chernay's black. So we have a dark lager, black lager. Pullet Mavi is a wonderful translation from half dark, which is amber. So we have a Pullet Mavi as well. And then our pale lagers, we have varying strengths.
And the Czechs have this wonderful way of categorizing styles where they have the strength in Plato, 10, 12, 14, et cetera, and then color, pale, amber, dark. And then it's like a grid, you know, pick that grid and you can have something. So you can have a amber lager, you know, 14 degrees Plato or 10 degrees Plato, depending on the strength. And so we follow that kind of grid pattern with Czech lager in the same way. So right now we have Tenor, which is a 10 Plato Czech pale lager. We have, well, right now, Pitchline Pils, which is a 12 Plato Czech pale lager. Pulit Mave, 11 Plato Czech pale lager. And then Tamave, which is a 12 Plato Czech dark lager. You know, 4%, 4.2%, 4.4%.
So that's the difference. I mean, when you say Plato, you, in their tradition, they would understand the strength. But do you have to translate it into ABV for us to understand?
We do. And Plato is basically the density of the wort previous to fermentation. And so that's going to be a predictor of alcohol content, you know, at the end of fermentation. And the Czechs kind of understand this. They know the 10 Plato beer is their session beer. 12 Plato is kind of like a standard strength, and 14 strong, and 16 is like, whoa, get out of the way. I'm going to really, you know, be careful here. And so we'll list that on the menu, but we also list the ABV. And, you know, Czech beer is not strong. So even like their stronger beers are only, like, you know, 5% alcohol. Like it's not a big beer. But we'll go from, you know, 4, 4.2, 4.4. We do have our Vol project line. Vol is basically German for full strength. And so we'll do full strength beers under a different label so people don't, you know, confuse it with the session beers that we produce. That can be everything from Fest beer. I just brewed a Czech dark lager or black lager, Cherné Special, which is going to be a 15 Plato, like 5.7% beer. So we want to celebrate those stronger beers for the reasons they're produced, but they have to be differentiated from our session beers that we produce so that people don't get in trouble.
So your strong beer is 5.7 when that's some people's lagers, right?
It is. But it's funny because our staff gets used to a certain strength. And the first year we had our Fest beer at 5.7% in Salem, our staff was used to basically having half liters or liters of 4.5% beer over the course of a couple of years. Then we came out with Fest beer at 5.7. And our staff got a little bit out of hand because they would drink it at the rate they would drink the lower strength beers. And they're like, that's not good. We don't really enjoy that. We have to throttle back a little bit next year. So yeah, I mean, it's all like, you know, how you consume beer and your relationship with beer. Like, the United States is definitely we've moved towards a flight. People don't drink beer in flights or stem glass and drink them slowly. And that's fine. There's a place for that. But, you know, Czech German beer, we're not sipping, we're drinking, right? We're not drinking to get inebriated, we're drinking for enjoyment. And there's a difference there. There's a cultural difference.
You know, that's a good point. I was thinking about, you know, drinking for enjoyment. I got 4.4%, even like a dry Irish stout, it's like 3.5%. So I guess that means I get to come here and drink more beer, right?
Well, I mean, that could be a side benefit for us, but I mean, the intent is that it's social. In Salem and in Brighton, when you come in, every table's communal. You don't own the table, you share it. And during COVID, that was hard because we couldn't do that. And COVID definitely put a wrench in the things we love to experience with our customers in terms of that communal aspect. But we're back there. So, you know, in Brighton, communal tables, beer garden, we have 36 communal tables that, you know, people can just come in and sit and chat and then strike up a conversation with the person next to them. And the fact that session beer allows you to stay longer. You know, there's no, you know, rush to go home. So you'll be okay. You know, you can have a few and you'll be okay.
So we're here in Boston. I know in New York now, if you show your vaccination card, you can go anywhere indoors. I've been in theaters. I've been in events. I've been in restaurants and it feels like normal. It's almost like you're an insider club. What does it require to come inside breweries and restaurants in Boston? Is there a mandate?
So there are mandates in both Salem and Boston, you know, where our brewery and tap rooms are. They're consistent in that if you're going to come inside, you must have a mask. Once you start eating or drinking, you can remove the mask. And that we're just following city guidance in that. Now that our staff is fully vaccinated and company-wide, we have a vaccination mandate. And then even in Salem, we have, in addition to that, staff must be tested once a week because we have such a tourist trade in Salem to make sure we're all okay. And the staff's been great about that. But from the customer standpoint, we just ask you to follow the local city guidance. We didn't do that last year because there was not a vaccination, and there was a lot of unknowns. So Salem was not open inside for over 18 months. We had everything outside because until our staff could get vaccinated, we were not going to open inside. And so we've been fortunate. Our staff, has been safe and they feel good about it. But yeah, I mean, it feels back to normal. It does, because people now share tables. They feel confident and they're vaccinated. Both our tap rooms are very open air. We have garage doors and multiple windows that open and doors that open. And there's a lot of air. What happens in the winter, I'm not really sure, but vaccination rates are going up. Massachusetts, knock on wood, has been a very, positive, accepting state for vaccinations. And so even if you have, gotten the virus, but you have been vaccinated, the impact has been minimal. So we feel fortunate to be the state we're in.
And Chris, what other, issues or challenges have arisen, now that COVID's been here for a year and a half? You have supply issues or production issues?
Supply issues have been huge. For us, a lot of what we do is obviously European influenced. And, a lot of our materials do come from Europe in terms of our glassware to our grain. And it's been a challenge. We source most of our grain for our Czech beers comes from the Czech Republic. We use Raven Malt, and then our grain for our German beers come from either Bamberg Malterie or Weyermann. We've had to go container for both of them direct, and hoping that container can get to us in a reasonable time. And there's been times where we had to shift production where we couldn't get German grain, and we went to all Czech production for a while. And so our menu all of a sudden was all Czech. Like more than it usually is. It's like, well, this is what we got to deal. It's not a bad thing, right? Then it shifted back to being heavily German because we couldn't get our Czech grain the way we wanted. But we've just been, we've rolled with the punches and just we had a motto when everything started. We're just going to do the best we can, and that's all you can ask of anyone, And hopefully, I think for the most part, our customers have been very forgiving, understanding. We're doing the best we can. We're providing the service that we can based upon labor shortages and all these kind of good things that, we've been able to achieve the quality we want. We don't always have the selection we want, but we definitely have the quality and people have recognized that.
Chris, it's great seeing you, man, because definitely Notch, for me, always just the quality of your beers and the style have stood out. You're a go-to place in Massachusetts, but also the way you've handled, equity issues and staffing and other things. It's not just really at the top of the game up here in Massachusetts. One thing about Massachusetts is that there's some really great breweries. It's a small state, but when I come up here, I have no problem drinking only Massachusetts.
It was not always the case. And it was not always the case because the breweries weren't there. Boston's fairly transient. And so we didn't have a consumer base that valued local. We didn't for a long time. I've been a production brewer in Boston since 1993. And I saw the indifference to local beers for decades. And it took a lot to get over that. And a lot of it was the local beer bars, and I'll call them out. They didn't care about local beer. They wanted things from faraway places that had cachet in a way that would never relate to local. Where you wouldn't see that in Portland, Maine. You wouldn't see that in Burlington, Vermont. You wouldn't see that in Denver, Colorado. And so it took a while to get there. And when it did, breweries that were shut out from beer bars, all of a sudden, it's like, all right, we're just going to go direct to the customer. We're going to go direct to the consumer in cans and draft. And that was kind of the tipping point, a bit. Breweries kind of had to flex a little bit and say, hey, man, we're good. I know you may not want to serve us, but we're going to go direct to the consumer. Notch has never been like that. We've always served most of our beer through beer bars, restaurants, and bars. And so we've always had that. That's the largest portion of our business, and we really value that relationship. But a lot of breweries said, "F it, we're going direct to the consumer." And so there's that kind of tension between distributed beer and then basically direct to consumer model. But with that direct to consumer model, we've seen a lot of breweries being able to survive and thrive because they didn't have to go through the wholesale model. And so you're seeing 200 plus breweries now in Massachusetts with a lot of great beer out there, consistent. Really great beer. And I see it, there's a lot of places I can go and even like local footprint in Salem, you know, I can go to like, you know, a dozen breweries within, you know, 30 minutes and like be really happy with the beers I'm getting. It's really wonderful. I'm really glad to see that scene grow. And it took a while to get there. Massachusetts was behind the rest of the country in terms of breweries. It was always thought of as a good beer city. And I never quite understood that because it wasn't. It took a long time to get where we are. And obviously now with New England IPA, which is dominated in a way that may not be positive, but at least it got like the focus on, all right, local beer is good beer. Yeah.
Wow, man, this is so cool. So this Pitchline Pils, I didn't even know you were going to have it until like yesterday. So I feel like I'm getting a special treat.
You were the first official customer.
Say that one more time.
You were the first official customer of Pitchline Pils version 4.
Thank you, Chris. So I come in 2 weeks and that's gone. Give me two other beers that I will have. And then also you could tell me about, there's a beer that's coming up that's triple decoction also. So there's three beers you got to tell me about.
So we always have a triple decoction beer on. Tenor, which is our 10 Plato, you know, 4% beer, which I think a lot of breweries look at and scratch their head, or consumers would like. So our lowest alcohol beer is actually our most labor-intensive beer to make, right? But we do that because we want to have the most flavor possible for that 4% beer. So Tenor is triple decocted. We do a lot of beers that are enhanced double decocted, which has the boil time of a triple, but it's slightly lower in terms of labor. So we have a Dunkel in Vienna coming out. And then the beer that's doing really, really well for us that I think people should try is Salem Lager. It's our year-round Helles that's available in 16-ounce cans and in draft as well. And that's a beer we really marry the Munich Bavarian process in terms of how we make that beer. That beer is not decocted. And so decoction's a really great tool, but I don't think it's always appropriate for all beers. And Helles, we have this different goal. Our goal with Helles is to have this honey and grape character in the beer, where I think decoction gets in the way of that. We have this additional process or other process with the Helles to get that, you know, really, really signature grapey honey character that Munich has. That in a way, I don't think you can get there with decoction. So decoction is not the end all. It's definitely a good tool for the beers that you want to have that impact on or have that flavor impact on, but not always like the end goal. So yeah, Salem Lager is a great one as well to look forward to.
So I'm here at Charles River Speedway. So this is technically Notch Brewing, Brighton, Boston. You said, yeah. And sorry, I'm on one mic. We're doing remote, first time in a long time. Thank you, Heritage Radio Network. But I want to try everything here. I remember like first time I went to Notch Brewing in Salem with some other friends and we recorded a show. I think you only had three or four of the Lucre handles on then. But now here at the new location in Brighton, you've got several towers of Lucre.
Yeah, so we always have, so they split. So all those, there's four handles, but two towers, they split. But we always have four Czech lagers on. We all will have two strengths of pale, a pullet Mavi, and a dark, either Tamavi or Chardonnay, all the time in Brighton. Salem, we typically have the same selection, you know. And because people want to roll in and be able to have, you know, our Czech pour through Lucre faucet with dense creamy foam in the Czech mug. And we want to make sure we have that experience. But we always layer on top of that our German lagers. And we do hoppy New England ales too, you know, because that's something we love and we don't shy away from that.
Then the last thing, last year when I saw you in Salem at Notch Brewing, you gave me this whole selection of different cans of yours. And one that stood out was the lightly smoked beer. Tell me about that. And also, I'll tell you what's cooking for next year in terms of smoked beer.
So we have a Rauch beer on at all times, or we try to have a Rauch beer at all times, because Bomberg, smoked lager, something that I love. And so we have basically a pale, which is a Helles Rauch beer called Lost in the Dream. We have an amber that's on right now, amber Rauch beer called Fire Walk With Me, which is a Twin Peaks David Lynch reference. And then we have Biersol, which is a dark Bomberg lager. And then we have a fourth, which is not of a Bomberg influence, but Grodzicki, which is an oak-smoked Polish wheat beer, which we do once a year and we love. It's really just an oddball beer. So, yeah, we have a high affinity for all those beers, all the rug beers. We love them quite a bit.
Yeah, if those are your fans of Mr. John Hall, a writer,
He's got a site. It's a secret Instagram site. It's called TW Rock Beer. This Week in Rock Beer. Check it out. There's like six posts, but I think if you send them $30, you're going to get a Camp Rock Beer t-shirt. And you never know. Maybe we'll come up here next summer and do a Camp Rock Beer event. Right, Chris?
I have to call John out because he called it Rausch Beer. I got to call him out, you know? Like you got to go with the German pronunciation.
Well, you're fortunate you got to travel. I mean, again, let's just go back. Fill us in. Evan Rail, your early influence in Czech beers. Wow. I mean, for most of us, you were way ahead of the game. What made you go then, and how did you get to meet Evan Rail, and tell us about him?
You know, I think part of it was because I had brewed ale only for so long, and when the company I was with sold, it allowed me to breathe a little bit and be a consumer. And as a consumer, I realized I just want to drink beers that are, you know, 4% alcohol. And there weren't a lot. This is, like, you know, 2005. And in 2005, you know, brewers are doing, you know, 6, 7, 8% beers and bombers. And I had no interest in that. That's not how I consume beer. I consume beer in volume and lower alcohol and like to sit around and hang out and enjoy that and you know, walk a straight line home. So Czech Republic was always on my list. So Czech Republic and then Munich and Bamberg, you know, it was my first trip there. And it was epiphany for me because, you know, I sat in, you know, beer bars in beer halls in Czech Republic where the beer was Desítka. It was basically the Tenor that we produce here, wildly flavorful, 4%. And I could have four in function. And they were some of the best tasting beers I've ever had. And so for brewer, you know, for a brewer to be able to achieve that was definitely a process goal that I wanted to get to. And so that's really why, you know, I got involved with that. And then Evan, I'm not sure how Evan and I got in contact. I think I just reached out to him and said, hey, man, I'm going to be in Czech Republic. I've been once as just basically just a tourist. And the second time back, I reached out to him because I read his writing and I ever wanted to understand a little bit more. And, you know, not knowing the language very well, and he had lived there for a bit and knew the language, just to have someone to kind of coach me through it. He was a great help. And then I just met a host of people since then in the Czech Republic. Just before COVID hit, Brianna and I, my production brewer, or our production brewer, who's since left on good terms, and, you know, I love her to death and I miss her, but, you know, she's left for other opportunities. But we got a chance to go to the Czech Republic. We brewed with three different breweries while we were there. Went to the University of Chemistry in Prague and did some coursework there and with the professors there, and just to, you know, basically, you know, advance our ability to brew and understand Czech lager. So I don't know. It's like, why does any brewer want to do anything? It's like they have a certain affinity for the beers, and typically the beers they want to drink. At least I hope it is. And for me, it's like I want to get deep in the beers I love to consume. I don't make beers for other people. I make them for myself, and maybe that's why we're a niche, you know?
Well, I think all good beers are going to be niche because, you know, it's like anything. Good cheese, or giving homage to our friend Ian Saxelby, helped promote American Farmstead cheeses. They're all small producers. Jasper Hill, I got the, just got today, sorry, man. I had this pitch line pills, I can't remember, but some Jasper Hill cheeses and Farmstead cheeses as well. But wow, that's it, man. So thanks so much, Chris, for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network, and congrats to everyone on the team. Thanks for this being the 600th episode. I gotta go because I'm gonna have more of this pitch line pills. Thanks so much. See you guys. Bye.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.